the room, as this will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from illness of alcoholism on the basis of these simple actions. These actions are contained in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA's simple actions. So I'll now read the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor mentions any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting this evening is an open big book self-study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting tonight pertaining to the step we discuss. And this evening, we're on step one. And I will read the first paragraph on page, let's see. We're in the preface, so we get to the Roman numerals. So this is page 16 or XXVI. And then the panel will share for a few minutes on each reading. And I'll take a moment just to introduce our panel. We have two really awesome recovering alcoholics with us tonight. We have Danny and Charlotte. So can we welcome them? Step one of the Program of Alcoholics Anonymous is that we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. And now we go to the first reading. The physician who, at our request, gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms that what we who have suffered alcohol and torture must believe, that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us. But we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may of course mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account.
Hey everybody, I'm an alcoholic. My name's Danny.
Hey Danny.
And first I'd like to take a quick second just to qualify a little bit. I told you I'm an alcoholic, and I do have a sobriety date. That's October 10th, 2010. I didn't get here because I wanted to be here. I kind of showed up slightly unwilling because I didn't know what else to do, and you guys showed me how to live a life sober, and it's been pretty cool. I have a home group. It's Downtown Young and Sober. We meet at 8 o'clock on Thursday nights over down the street on Freemason. You're welcome to join us. Young does not mean you have to be young. It's just a friendly place for young people to come and congregate and talk about a solution. the solution that we find in this book. So first, I'm a little bit nervous, and I always am. You know, I don't enjoy coming in and speaking at Alcoholics Anonymous things. There's that little part of my ego that gets stroked. But really, I do it because when I got sober and my sponsor asked me if I was willing to go to any lengths to recover from alcoholism, he told me that we were going to bang through the steps and we were going to take care of me so I could get to the business of helping others, because that's why I'm really here. So with that being said, you know, David asked me to speak a month or so ago, and he asked me what step I wanted, and it didn't take me a lot of time to say step one. You know, we don't talk about alcohol a whole lot in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love talking about the problem. You know, if I want to recover, it's a good idea for me to start with what I need to recover from. And that's exactly what my sponsor told me when I first showed up here. He asked me what step I was on, and I told him I thought I was on step four. And that's when I found out anytime you think you're on a step, you're probably a few steps before that. And he asked me where I was in the big book, and I think I said somewhere around like to the employer. And he said, have you read the doctor's opinion? And I asked him what that was. And that gave him enough knowledge about me to know we were going to start from the beginning. And I'm really glad that we did. You know, when I got here, all I really knew was that I like to drink. And when I drink, I tend to drink a lot, and then some things happen that I'm not normally overly fond of. You know, repercussions start building up, people start looking at me kind of funny, I start getting pressure from, you know, family members and stuff to, like, you know, clean up my act a little bit. You know, that's all I really know when I get here. I still have the stereotypical ideal of what an alcoholic is, and that's, you know, some homeless guy sleeping on a bench, hugging his bottle of booze when it's, you know, 30 degrees outside. That's my idea of what an alcoholic is. I don't match that. Therefore, I'm fine. And let's keep drinking. And I show up to you guys because things are not looking so hot. And you told me in very simple suggestions what I ought to do if I wanted my life to get a little bit better. So outright mental defective. You know, when I got here, I would have been absolutely appalled if you would have called me that. Retrospectively, that's a little more fitting. You know, my sponsor talked to me a little bit about, you know, sanity and insanity with regards to the first drink. And when I showed up, I thought I was just drinking because I wanted to get drunk. And when I take a look back and see my pattern as to, you know, I get drunk, I do stupid things, I say I'm not going to get drunk, or I'm not going to get that drunk again, or if I'm going to get drunk, these are the circumstances that are going to be different. But inevitably, no matter how hard I try, I keep doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. And if that isn't insanity, I'm not sure what is. And I would also compare myself to others. You know, I didn't have a baseline for how I was doing other than, you know, what people around me are doing. So I put myself in situations where the other people around me are similar to me. And when I'm walking like around campus, I was going to ODU when I got sober. And when I'm walking around campus, I see everybody I've got this brain that just won't stop thinking. And I'm thinking, you know, what are they thinking about what I'm thinking about? And you know, it just keeps going and keeps going. And it's absolutely torture. And the one thing that the only baseline that I have to judge mental stability is my own mental stability. And when that's off, that's a really dangerous place to be. So when I got here and it was explained to me that I can't fix a broken brain with a broken brain, that made a little bit of sense to me, because I'd been trying to do it for a really long time and I hadn't gotten very good results. And as far as, you know, the physical allergy is what we're going to be talking about a lot today. You know, that's the part one of step one. And, you know, when about 2 weeks before I showed up here, I'm going to skip forward a little bit and just read one little thing because I think it's pretty important. And my uncle, who's a member of this program, paraphrased this to me when we were eating lunch one day. And, you know, 2 weeks later, I got arrested and then had the first bit of knowledge that I needed to start taking an honest look at my drinking. And it's page 44, and all it says is, if when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. And I don't have an outright definition of alcoholism, but that's the best one that I've ever heard of, and I definitely fit both of those criteria. And I would like to point out that it's an or, not an and.
Hi, everybody. I'm Charlotte. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Charlotte.
I have a home group that is Cornerstone. And it meets here in this very same church on Saturday nights at 7 o'clock. It's a big book study, and I'd love to see some of y'all there. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. My sobriety date is July 18, 2013. And I'd like to talk a little bit, qualify myself a little bit, just in case any of you were wondering. I love to drink as well. I can agree with Danny, and I have a lot of good times drinking. I started the very first time I drank in high school and caught that buzz, I was forever chasing that. But it's not real convenient to drink in high school when you don't have that ID. And so it wasn't a problem for a long time. The problem became a problem when I wanted to stop and I couldn't. And that was probably in my 20s, I started to realize that I had a problem. And, you know, I had some issues. I've shared this many times before, but I have two children that are special needs and a husband that's in the Navy that's deployed quite often and just didn't like the way I felt ever. Just didn't like the way my life had turned out. And I could drink and that made everything okay for a long time. And at the end, I was drinking all day, every day, pretty much. I love this chapter. I got a sponsor really early on, and we immediately started going through the book, and we started at the very beginning. And when we read this, I didn't really understand it. When I first came in and I was told that, you know, read this and told about the allergy, what I thought was that I had created an addiction in myself, that I was dependent on alcohol and that I had done that to myself. And I didn't really understand, but I just went along with it because, you know, this is what you guys told me. I understand a lot better today what that means. Not only do I have this obsession that alcohol is going to be okay, that the next time is going to be okay, and that I'm going to be able to successfully drink, I have this allergy as well, and we'll get into that more later. But the problem with me is I couldn't stop even when I had every reason to stop. And, you know, I didn't want to be, I thought I was a good person. I couldn't understand why all these bad things had happened to me. I didn't want to be the mom that drove drunk with her kids in the car. And I didn't want to be the mom that passed out. I mean, at the end, I was literally passing out during the day with my kids. I have a daughter that suffers seizures and a son that's all over the place. I didn't want to be that. But more than anything, I knew I was poisoning myself. I mean, at the very end, I knew that the amount of alcohol I was consuming, there was no way my liver could metabolize it. And I knew that and I didn't want to go to the doctor because I knew this. And I knew I was killing myself and I didn't want to die. And I think at some point, years before, I thought I may end up in AA. I may end up there, but I did not realize how life was going to be good in AA. I thought I had to get miserable enough in my drinking that I thought, well, I might as well be miserable in AA. So, you know, this I would urge any newcomers to pay attention as much as possible, because I know at first I couldn't really pay attention that well to this chapter. Dr. Silkworth was we owe a lot to him, and when he first wrote this, he did not want to sign it. And I think the first edition, even the anniversary edition's out, his signature's not in it. But you know, once the fellowship grew after the publication of this book, this textbook really that teaches us how to live, he was more than willing to have his name put on it. I think that's all I have for now. Thanks. Thank you.
Okay, so continuing right along, we are in the doctor's opinion, not the former. On page 18, XXBI, on the first paragraph. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all, and once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve.
Should I introduce myself as an alcoholic every time? Okay.
We know you.
All right. It's just strange talking in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and not starting with that. It just feels off. But that phenomenon of craving, you know, when my dad was an alcoholic and he talked about, you know, he talked with me some about the allergy and stuff like that. I think he was trying to prepare me because he knew that there was a good chance that I would be an alcoholic as well. But I remember when I was like 14, 15 years old, before I had really even started, you know, the bulk of my drinking career, I remember him telling me about, you know, this allergy. And I just chalked it off as, yeah, Dad's being silly, you know. And I already decided that I knew best at like 14 years old, something that I have absolutely no experience, no knowledge, nothing about. I've already decided that my idea is much better than my dad's, who's an alcoholic, who's going to these AA meetings. That's silly. You can't have an allergic reaction to alcohol. You drank plenty of it and you didn't have hives all over you. You're fine, you know? But it's, you know, it's not an allergy in the sense that you know, I break out. It's an allergy. I have an abnormal sensitivity to this. When I put this in my body, there's an abnormal reaction. And what that reaction is that it makes me want to drink more and more and more. And the more that I drink, the more that I want to drink until I black out or pass out. Or, you know, if I look back in my drinking career, I can find a few specific examples where, like, maybe adrenaline kept me from wanting to drink more when the cops were involved and things like that. But for the most part, if I have any choice in the matter, I'm getting absolutely as drunk as I possibly can. Thank you very much. And I might have the self-control once or twice to have a couple of beers, but once I start to feel that buzz, it's extremely difficult for a guy like me to say no and put it down. And I had a little bit of trouble understanding that for a long time. And then I started looking back at, you know, a few of the times. I only lived in Virginia for a month before I got sober, and I didn't drink as much in that month as I would have liked to, because I was living with my uncle, who's a member of this fellowship. And so, of course, I was, you know, trying to hide the drinking. And I was going to school at ODU, and I had this great idea that I could just bring, you know, a bottle. I put some whiskey in a Dasani bottle, which I later found 2 years sober at Wakefield in my toolbox in my truck. That's how cleanly I was when I got here. Johnny, that's for you. But anyways, so I had this grand idea of how I'd take this Dasani bottle with brown liquid in it, which completely does not look like water anyways, and I'd go to Burger King and I'd step into the bathroom with my soft drink and make it into a hard drink. And that was a completely rational idea of how to drink a little bit while I was living with, you know, a recovering alcoholic, which was like not on my list of fun places to be living at the time. And what I noticed then was, and I didn't, you know, put two and two together until I got sober and started looking at the doctor's opinion and looked back. But when I got home, I tried this two times, and both times it was the exact same. I had one of those little breathalyzers from Brookstone, and I was like right at 0.08, 0.09, which is the legal limit. And I felt like I was like just barely even buzzed. Like, what's the point of even, you know, drinking that small amount? And I get home and I go up to my room, and both nights it was a weeknight, and my uncle really should have been in his bed at like midnight by the absolute latest. And I remember just sitting up in my room, just, you know, the wheels are turning in my head, and all of a sudden, for absolutely no reason other than I'm an alcoholic and I can't do what I want to do because my uncle's still up and I can't go out to the truck and bring that bottle back into the house without him noticing because he's in the office, which is right next to the front door, and it's also inconveniently located close to the back door as well. And the wheels are turning in my head, and all of a sudden I have this huge resentment towards my uncle for checking his email. But that's how my brain works, because I've got this phenomenon of craving that I really, really need to finish that job. And for me to have a few beers and then call it quits, for me to get to a nice, warm, fuzzy feeling and then call it quits is not warm and fuzzy at all. It's freaking aggravating, and I don't see the point. And to be completely honest, I don't understand social drinkers, you know? And I didn't take a step back and look at my drinking well enough while I was doing it to understand that. But once I get here and I get sober and I can take a look at my drinking, I absolutely had no interest in drinking a little bit. I can count numerous times where people would bring like a 6-pack or a 12-pack, and there are like 3 or 4 people here, and they ask me if I want a beer, and I say, no, I'm good, you know? Normally you ask me if I want a beer and I say, give me 2. But if you don't have enough for me to get where I need to get, without even actually knowing it, I know that that just doesn't look like a good time to me. Thanks, I'll pass, you know? And the funny part is that I'm an alcoholic, so I'm gonna use that as proof as to why I'm not an alcoholic, because I turned down beer the other day. That's all I got.
Thanks, Danny. Yeah, Danny reminded me, I used to like to go to Target with the kids, and I would have alcohol for the drive there, and then I would make myself a drink and like a soda cup, and I would almost feel kind of smug about it. Like, I'm walking around Target with, you know, drinking my drink with my kids, and nobody knows. And of course, yeah, I'm sure they didn't know, but it's crazy. Yeah, I didn't come from an alcoholic family, so I didn't, I really can't, you know, I have a grandfather that they say used to be kind of wild. I think that was more with the women. But he wasn't when I knew him. And my parents, I've never seen either one of them drunk. They enjoyed drinking. My dad's German stock, and he loved to have a couple beers. And my mom would have a wine cooler or two to relax. But I never saw them drunk. So I couldn't really blame, you know, I couldn't really bring that into the into my equation anyway. What I can relate to so much here, though. Having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up in them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. You know, I thought I had it. I mean, I thought I would be happy. I had a great husband. I had, you know, granted, 2 of my children have issues, but I love them like crazy, and I didn't have to work for a while. You know, I should have been happy, but nothing could fill that void for me. And I was just more resentful of everything that my life had turned out to be. And I drank over it over and over again. And I couldn't stop. And at some point, I gave up trying to stop. But I realized after I came in the program that I always believed I would stop. I always believed something would happen, like my grandfather, who finally settled down, that would happen. I would get old. I'd have some grandkids, everything would be good, and I wouldn't want to do this anymore. And the realization one morning when I woke up and realized, you know, like I said, that I was poisoning myself, that I was going to die an alcoholic death, I knew that. I knew that, you know, it was going to be horrible and leave behind so much disaster, and that I couldn't stop. It's really scary. And I, you know, my problems, I remember that I would be drunk because I was drunk all the time, and I would say, well, I'll pay the bills when I'm drunk tomorrow, right? Or I'll do this when I'm drunk tomorrow. It's like I knew that I had to be drunk to do whatever I was going to do, but even though I was drunk at the time, I couldn't do it. And it was just completely ridiculous. Yeah, that's all I have on that right now. Thank you.
Okay, so moving along, just right now on that page, the bottom paragraph. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot after time differentiate the true from false. To them, their alcoholism a sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks, drinks which they see others taking with impunity. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of the spree, emerging remorseful, with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery.
Well, that sucks. We're going to talk a little bit more about that entire psychic change later, but I love the first sentence of that. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. I like to get drunk. That's the Big Book just told me that I drink because I like to get drunk, and I can relate with that. I can get drunk, you know, it's like green eggs and ham, except instead of don't, it's like, yeah, let's do that. That's a great idea. I don't care where I am. If we're on a train, on a plane, I'm getting drunk. Let's have fun. You know, that's the kind of guy that I am, you know. And I remember the first time that I really got drunk, you know, I'd had a little bit of booze here and there before, you know, maybe caught a little bit of a buzz, had a couple of beers with my older brother because I thought that was cool. We iced them in a little plastic bucket, had a couple of Budweiser long necks, thought we were classy drinking in the basement, you know. I'd done that, and actually, I had to choke them down. I thought they tasted disgusting, you know. But as soon as I get drunk for the first time, my whole world changed. You know, I had always felt not necessarily less than, just a little bit different than, if that makes sense. You know, I told myself that I was better than everybody else, but really I felt a little bit worse than everybody else. And somewhere in between that, I just felt different. And I don't know exactly how to describe it other than, you know, if you look when I was in middle school and even when I was in high school at lunch, you know, I could sit with these people, I could sit with these people, I could sit with these people, or I could sit with these people. And they all were all right with me, but I never had that one place where I fit in. And that's a constant theme in my childhood, is that, you know, I can act a little bit different so that you're going to accept me. And I'm not necessarily like a loser, a guy that everybody looks at and nobody wants to be around, at least not starting out. But I just never have that home base where I can fit in, those, that crew that I can just, you know, call any of those guys up and, you know, they're going to call and have my back, that sort of thing. You know, I fit in with everybody, but I don't have that one place. And then I get drunk, and I do, and absolutely nothing on the outside changes. And that's the funny part, is the only thing that changes is something inside of me, my perception to life, you know. I believe that I have a spiritual experience every time I get drunk. The problem is, it runs out in the morning, you know. And that's my experience, is that I get drunk and finally these guys that only let me hang out with them because I was Tim's little brother and they kind of had to put up with me, finally, they don't put up with me because I'm Tim's little brother. We're having fun because I'm one of the guys, you know? And the only thing that changed was my perception, because I was sober and then I got drunk. I was, you know, that's the only difference. And so I start to put myself around people like that, and my excuse is I just like to party, you know? And I have to find new friends because the friends that I currently have aren't drinking the way that I like to drink, you know? And the guys that I went to high school with, I'll call them up on Saturday and ask what they're doing, and they'll say, oh, I'm just staying in tonight, man. I got drunk last night. Like, well, it's the weekend. You're supposed to get drunk all weekend. We're in college. Did you not get the handbook that was given to me, you know? And it might have been the other way around, I don't know. But I know that I had to find some new friends, and I did. That's what I did, you know? If you're not doing what I want you to do, it's all about me, you know? And if you're not doing what I want you to do, I'm going to find somebody that will. And I treated everybody in my life that way, with very few exceptions. You're disposable if you're not buying in to my reality, you know? And the problem is that when you live your life that way, you keep getting more and more of these little problems that you just push off to the next day, and they never really get solved. So I showed up to Alcoholics Anonymous with a lot of little problems, a lot of people that didn't care for me a whole lot, a lot of, you know, well, I'm not really the greatest at paying my bills and things like that, you know, because that's, you know, like Charlotte said, I'll do that tomorrow. That's future Danny's problem, you know. And the problem is that future Danny never shows up. I was listening to a really nerdy podcast, and Stephen Hawking was running late for something, and one of the writers said that that guy has no concept of time, and I thought that was kind of funny, and I was going to share that with you. That's not AA related at all. I just thought it was funny. thanks, David. But, you know, alcohol isn't my problem, it's my solution. You know, when I'm drinking, that is my medicine for alcoholism. If you take a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and set it next to a bottle, pretend this is a liquor bottle, and ask me when I'm one day sober which one looks like it has a solution in it, I'm picking up this one. And that's all there is to it. I've got a one-stop solution for all of my problems, and it's called oblivion. And if I live life sober on my own regard, eventually I'm going to get restless, irritable, and discontent enough. I'm going to get irritated with you, and you guys are just going to be in the way of me and my objectives enough until I can't stand it anymore. And my only two options left, my only three options, are putting a bullet in my head, taking a drink, or accepting a spiritual solution which you guys have to offer. Thank you.
Thanks, Danny. Yeah, that's one of my favorite sentences in the whole book. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Thank you. That says it all. That's what I've, you know. And the thing is, and I think I just realized this when I was talking before about I'll pay my bills tomorrow when I'm drunk. I think what I was probably referring to is that little window, like after that first drink, maybe the second drink, when you're starting to feel good and life is good and you're giggly and even the kids like me at that point because I'm fun mom. And, you know, and that's where most people stay. Most normal drinkers, when they're drinking to have a good time, that's where they'll stay. But that phenomenon of craving, and when the book refers to craving, it's talking completely, I didn't realize this, I was listening to a speaker tape about the body. It's not a mental thing. That develops, and I can't stop. I can't, even though I know I'm going to pass from that fun stage into the angry, crying, beat my husband's head against the wall, say horrible things to my kids, cuss at my kids, pass out, get into fights with the neighbors, the police get called. I mean, even though I know that that's all going to happen again, I can't stop. It's just one, you know, it's just never enough. And I'm going to drink until I pass out. Ease and comfort. That's what I'm looking for, but that's not what happens. And the next morning, I wake up and thinking, like I said at the end, I think I knew it was just going to happen again. But, you know, there was certainly that period of time when I thought, I'm not going to do it. I think my last attempt at controlling my drinking was, I'll just start drinking at 9 at night. I'll just do that, and that way I'll have, you know, just a few, and then I'll go to sleep. And we know how that worked out. I mean, it just didn't. And we'll talk, like Danny said, we'll talk more about that psychic change and the few simple things that I needed to do to experience that and to be relieved of the obsession and therefore not succumbing to that craving. That's all I have right now.
Thank you. Okay, so moving along to the next page, page 14. I do not hold with those who believe alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. I have had many men who have, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal which was to be settled on a certain date favorably to them. They took a drink a day or so prior to the date, and then the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all other interests, so that an important appointment was not met. These men were not drinking to escape. They were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. There are many situations which arise out of the phenomenon of craving, which cause men to make the supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight.
Drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. I had an experience when I read this with my sponsor. He asked me to read it 30 days in a row every day, and then we'd get together and read it. And I was a little insulted at first. I thought that, I'm a big boy, I'm in college, I have a pretty good reading comprehension, and I'm going to read this and I'm going to understand it, and I don't know what the redundancy is about, but it's quite annoying if you ask me. So after 30 days of reading this, almost every day, I was pretty good. I might have missed a day or two in there. And going over this, there's a lot of stuff that I just don't have the capability of getting on my own intellect unless somebody shares it in a way where they relate it to their experience, and this was definitely one of them. Drinking to overcome a craving beyond my mental control. I never really got that. I thought I was always choosing to pick up a drink, you know? Sometimes I don't think about it that much. Sometimes I just get angry and decide we're gonna get drunk. Sometimes I'm specifically drinking at something, but sometimes, you know, just bored, let's get drunk. Whatever the reason may be, it's always my decision in my mind, you know? And the best way I've ever heard it described, I forget which circuit speaker, but he talks about, you know, the problem is the spring that gets stuck in my gut while I'm sleeping. Once I'm sober for a couple of days, you know, I can go a few days without alcohol. I was never a daily drinker. I mean, at times I was a daily drinker, but I was never an every single day drinker. If I could get away with it, I was getting drunk for a few days in a row, but for the most part, you know, I would, you know, drink four or five times a week. I'd take a couple days off, you know, and the problem is that when I stay sober, when I don't have a solution for a couple of days, there's this spring that's stuck in my gut and it just slowly starts to twist, and as it gets worse, each little thing that you say that isn't what I want you to say starts to twist a little bit more. And what I was saying earlier, you just, instead of being a part of my life, you start to become more and more just an obstacle that I have to get through to get to what I want to do, you know? I have to be home at this time, and I don't know why, because I don't have anything in particular that I want to do, but you're talking to me, and I want to be home, not talking to you, so that's a problem. And that's untreated alcoholism right there, and that can rear its ugly head when I'm stone cold sober, you know? That's it. Whether with or without a solution, today, working these 12 steps, that happens much, much less. But if I'm not working on, if I don't have that daily reprieve that's contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition, that can come right on back today. You know, my boss is talking to me. I don't really know why. He just seems to keep talking about stuff that I don't really care about. He's paying me hourly, but I don't care about that either because I just want to be home, you know? And that's how my brain works, you know? If I don't have a solution working in my life on a daily basis, that starts to happen until I can't, until I need relief from it in one way or another, until I'm at a point where I am absolutely in such mentally agonizing pain that I need relief from one way or the other, and I'm going to find it, whether it's in a bottle, whether it's in competition, video games, sex, you name it. There's something that's going to happen that's going to relieve me from this. And before I got here, alcohol fit it the best, and it fit it the longest. You know, there were other things that I could throw in that, you know, God-shaped hole that would take care of it for a certain amount of time. But in my experience, even alcohol, everything fills it for a certain amount of time, but eventually, you know, it goes away. And that goes back to the entire psychic change that was mentioned in the previous chapter. Unless I can experience that entire psychic change, which I'm not capable of bringing about based on my own power, unless I can experience that, which is just a direct result of doing these steps, you know, unless I can experience that, I have absolutely no hope of overcoming alcohol, of recovering. And until I can surrender completely to that idea, I'm just gonna keep drinking. I was talking to a friend a couple days ago, and I'm kind of a nerd, I alluded to that earlier. But Ulysses S. Grant, his nickname was Unconditional Surrender Grant, and I didn't really completely understand why when I was younger. I thought, you know, he just liked to kill people, whatever, but I don't know. But what that was about was that when he was fighting a Confederate army and they wanted to surrender and said, we're going to surrender, but we want this, this, and this. He would say, no, I'm kicking your ass. I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing until you're absolutely done. And he was relentless until they said, I surrender, no conditions, I just surrender. And that's what I need in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I come here, I've still got a few ideas. And this big book and going through the doctor's opinion showed me that my ideas aren't going to work. And some people need to go back out and take another drink. It suggests in the big book that you do that if you're not sure of your condition. I'm thankful that I wasn't one of those people, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. At the end of the day, you know, if it comes between a bad case of the jitters and questioning whether you're an alcoholic or not, it might be worth it to get a true knowledge of your condition. That's all I got. Thank you.
Thanks, Danny.
Thank you.
I was listening to Joe and Charlie early on in my recovery, and I don't know if any of you guys, I'm sure you have, but they're awesome, and they have a big book study on tape. Let me know if you want a copy. I'll make you one. But, you know, they're talking about, when they talk about the doctor's opinion, about the research that's been done since the book was written that proves that, indeed, alcoholics actually do have a very, you know, different reaction to alcohol. So I was going to try and impress you guys and put it in the Google machine and come up with some really cool research and talk about it. But I found when I did that, a lot of stuff came up disproving it. It's just like with Alcoholics Anonymous. If you Google, will Alcoholics Anonymous work, you're going to get a lot of stuff that says it doesn't. What it tells me in this book is I must believe that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. I came into AA and I, like I said, found a sponsor that started immediately taking me through these steps, and the obsession to drink left me pretty quickly. I know that's not everybody's experience, but it was mine, and I was very grateful for, and still continue to be extremely grateful for that. That's a miracle. But I have to be, and I was never one of these people that I hear that quit drinking for, I couldn't go a day at the end. For years, I couldn't go a day without drinking. So I never really experienced that, but I'll take your word for it that it's pretty bad. But in finding that spiritual solution in these steps, that relieves that obsession of the mind. And I believe that I'm not, you know, this lady at work, I got a great crock pot recipe for corned beef. You get a can of beer. No, not doing it. I'm not going anywhere near it. I believe now that my body is different, and that one or two is never going to be enough. And I don't know if, like my friend Jill says, I don't know if I may have a good drunk in me, but I don't know if I have another good getting sober. So I will continue to take care of my spiritual condition, and I don't want to drink anyway, so it's just not even an issue. Thanks.
Thanks.
Okay, and moving right along to the next paragraph, which starts with all these, down at the bottom of page 30. So all these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity, and has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence.
I don't know about you guys, but when I showed up here, entire abstinence from alcohol sounded like a lot of things, but relief was not among them. You know, you guys get here and you kind of trick me, you know. I'm a big fan of logic. I think logic can solve lots of problems. I like math, and I understand that 2 + 2 = 4 and all that. And what I came to realize, and I didn't do it intentionally, was that if I grasp both parts of what alcoholism is, the only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence is what comes out of that equation. But the problem for me, you know, so if I take this and I see, and I can fully concede that I've got a body that once I put it in it, I can't stop drinking, and I've got a brain that no matter how hard I try on my own willpower is gonna talk me into taking another drink. If I can concede both of those points, the only logical solution is entire abstinence, and for an alcoholic like me, that's pretty scary. Cause I, you know, maybe I had a drinking problem, you know, cause, you know, I did some bad things when I was drinking, and when I drank a lot. But more than that, I have a solution, or I have a sober problem. I have a life problem. I don't know if I'm just maladjusted to life, like we talked about in the first paragraph. That's starting as I go through this. This becomes more and more of an option. I don't know if that's the case or not, but what I do know is that entire abstinence sounds like agony. You know, when I first show up here and you tell me don't put a drink in you know, people that say put the plug in the jug, you know, just go to meetings and don't drink, you'll be all right. I'll be all right for 30 days, maybe 90 days, but eventually one of two things is going to happen. I'm either going to kill myself, I'm going to take a drink, or I'm going to crack this book open and start working these steps, because for an alcoholic like me, I don't have any other solution. I don't have any other choice. That's it. And when I come to that point where I realize that I absolutely have no other option than those three, and to be completely honest, when I got here, none of those three sounded very good. I got to a place where I saw what my life was going to look like if I continued drinking, and I absolutely, with every fiber of my being, did not want that. I got arrested October 8th, October 9th, something like that of 2010, and I was sitting in the Virginia Beach, in the oceanfront precinct. They transferred me over to Virginia Beach General, and there's this old crusty dude sitting there with this big old beard, and he's just hanging out, just chilling, just another time in the drunk tank, no big deal. He wasn't too worried about it. They're going to give him a fine that he's probably not going to pay, and he's just going to go back out on the street, no big deal. And I had this epiphany that if I continue to drink, that that's my absolute best case scenario. The arresting officer had recently told me that he found me passed out underneath a parked car, and I had the information about Alcoholics Anonymous fresh in my mind that once I start drinking, if I have little or no control over the amount I take, or when I sincerely try and stop, I find that I cannot, I'm probably an alcoholic. And sitting there in that jail cell with that guy sitting across from me and that information in my head, I came to a really hard place where all I knew is that I don't know what to do. You know, that was the only thing that I knew with every fiber of my being. I knew that I didn't want to drink again. I knew that I absolutely could not take a drink or my life would end up like that, and that was something that I wasn't okay with. I would rather, and maybe it's ego, but I would have rather have killed myself that day than continue to drink and know that I was going to end up that way. That was one option. So I had kill myself, end up like that, or accept a spiritual solution. And to be completely honest, I wasn't entirely sure which one sounded the best. So when I come to a place like that, and you tell me that entire abstinence is my only solution, I can kind of understand that. But it still doesn't sound like a solution. But I show up here, and you guys have this big old goofy smile on your face, and you're talking about how I feel with words that I don't have to describe how I feel. The first meeting that I went to, I had this conception that when I showed up to Alcoholics Anonymous, it was going to be a bunch of old crusty people, you know, sitting around chain smoking cigarettes, drinking coffee. And the first meeting that I went to was Craddock, and I walked in there, and I was like, wow, I was right. And those guys that day, I don't remember exactly what they said, but they were talking about how I felt, and they were talking, they had a smile on their face, and they were laughing about things that I was crying about. And I knew at that moment that I'm not sure what the hell these guys are on, but what they're doing, I got to get some of it because my life isn't working out that well. And it wasn't easy. You know, I showed up, I grabbed a sponsor, I worked through the steps. There's been significant amounts of complacency and self-inflicted pain. But I'm here and I'm sober today and I wouldn't trade it for the world. Thank you.
Thanks, Danny. Yeah, abstinence didn't sound really good to me either. But like Danny, I thought at one point that I would quit when I had grandchildren. You know, when my kids got older and I had grandchildren, I could see me, like another friend in the fellowship talks about sitting out on the front porch, sipping the wine, watching the grandchildren play. So I would be able to control it or not drink at all at that point. And then at some point I thought, well, I'll be the tipsy grandma, you know. It'll be like, grandma smells funny, but she's fine. Yay, grandma. And then my daughter was pregnant right before I went into detox, and I thought, I'm not gonna see this baby. There's a real chance that I won't be a part of this baby's life. I'll either be dead or she won't let me see this baby. And that didn't sound good at all. I talked a little bit about, you know, the phenomenon of craving and, you know, all the research that's out there, whatever, but I believe that complete abstinence is best for me. But I never thought that I would not want to drink. That was my biggest misconception as a newcomer, that I would be fighting this urge to drink for the rest of my life. But in taking these steps and working with a sponsor and coming to meetings and getting to know you guys, I had that psychic change. And psychic doesn't mean that we can all read your minds and we're going to make you change. Psychic is, you know, can be a confusing word. I looked it up a while back, and it's got several definitions, but the one that seemed to fit was mind and soul, you know, a change of the mind and soul. And, you know, that's the only way that I can explain it, to go from somebody who couldn't live without drinking, who didn't want to drink and couldn't stop and was killing myself, to someone who gets up every morning and prays and asks God to show me what I can do to help whoever crosses my path that day. It's pretty amazing, and I have a great time and I have a great life. I really do. I believe that AA saved my life. Not only did it save my life, but it just made it better than I ever could have expected. And so drinking is not even an issue anymore. It's just, as long as I continue to take care of my spiritual condition, practice these principles, drinking is not an issue for me. Thank you.
Thank you, Charlotte and Andy. Well, that brings us to the end of our readings this evening. At this time, we will pass the seventh tradition basket. And the seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local service, district, area, and adult service offices remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, which again is to help alcohol abuse those suffers. The amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world. So at this time, we open the meeting up for announcements. Are there any AA-related announcements?
My name's Donald, alcoholic. Reading the big book and reading the film as well. We're having on the 15th of November, it's on Fulton Street, 3 blocks off of Little Creek. We're having the AA, they award the Bill Wilson movie, which stars Bill Wilson. He talks about his drinking career and his sobriety. It's Bill Wilson himself. One of the guys that Chris sponsors, I'm his grand sponsor, is making popcorn with coconut oil. He's got an old popcorn maker. best popcorn you ever eat in your life. They're free, and they got coffee and soft drinks, and it's in the center hall in the back of Third Presbyterian Church on Carlton Street, three blocks off of Little Street.
All
right,
interviews.
So, yeah, and it'll be interviews, less animals. Okay. So this is like one of the most important parts of the meeting. This is regarding newcomers. Newcomers are the most important people here today. Is there anyone here that's in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would like to get to know you. Could you please introduce yourself by your first name so we can welcome you?
Thank you.
got to eat.
I need to eat.
Okay, Evan, you can take us out with the Lord's Prayer, okay? Consolation Christ.
Yeah. You guys all link up? Any hand will do. All right. Who keeps us sober?
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever.